Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon, listeners. This is Military Monday on the Rightstream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a warm and muggy day in Fairfax, Virginia. But hey, we're supposed to have some of those in the middle of July here in the middle of the DC metro area. And with that said, we're going to kick off our first news show for July with something that's a little different and I like to think a little fun. One of the more intriguing aspects of military aircraft design is the fact that somebody has to go and come up with new ideas. Now, new ideas in the aviation world tend to be very carefully explored, researched, and tested. And one of the mechanisms that is used to test new ideas is the research aircraft, or as we have come to know them here in the United States, the X-planes. X-planes began after World War II as purpose-designed aircraft, frequently powered by a new generation of rocket motors, of all things, to go ahead and explore regimes of flight which previously had either been inaccessible or just impossible to reach for a variety of reasons. There are four great X-planes that came into service and provided testing platforms over the next 21 years. You're probably familiar with the one called the X-1, sort of an orange-painted beast dubbed Glamorous Glennis by its chief pilot, the legendary Chuck Yeager. But we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about the fourth one in that line, something called the X-15. And we're going to talk with the author, actually the co-author, of a new book from Zenith Press on the subject. And with his co-author, John Anderson, Richard Passman has gone and made a major contribution to the telling of the X-15 story in a manner that I think is consistent for people who've never seen it. There have been previous books on the X-15. We're going to talk about a couple of them here probably today, including the more or less de facto program history by Milt Thompson. But we are proud today to welcome to Military Monday Richard Passman. Richard, are you there, sir?
I am. I'll be pleased to talk about the X-15.
Let's start a little bit about talking about you first, sir, because we like to go and give people an idea who we're talking to. My understanding was you were a World War II naval aviator who flew off carriers, correct?
I was in flight training, and the war ended, and I got out and continued my education with a master's degree in aeronautical engineering at Michigan. And a degree in engineering mathematics. I went to Bell Aircraft, who were making the X-1, and I had studied supersonic aerodynamics, and they offered me an opportunity to work on airplanes like the X-1. And so I did work on the X-1. I was the chief aerodynamicist on the X-2. For about 8 years. I did design the X-16, which was not really a research airplane, but they used research aircraft money. And I followed that career in space with General Electric, and I was responsible for reentry vehicles for intercontinental ballistic missiles and for space vehicles, including the manned orbiting lab. And so that I later I worked also on the International Space Station, but that gives you an idea. And it's really the time at Bell Aircraft and the X airplanes that I became acquainted with the subject of the X-15. And I've been a volunteer since I retired at the Air and Space Museum, working with John Anderson, who is one of the world's experts in hypersonic flow. And together we put together this book on the airplane. Now, the airplane itself is a fighter-sized airplane. It's rocket-propelled, and it was to explore hypersonic flow, that is, Mach numbers of 5+. Now, Mach number of 1 is the speed of sound, so a Mach number of 5 is 5 times the speed of sound. It was to investigate flying at altitudes in space to go up to really 250,000 feet. It actually went to 354,200 feet to learn about aerodynamic heating, because hypersonic flow is really about the heat that occurs at Mach number 5+. And that needed special materials. So the external materials on the X-15 were made of Inconel X exterior. And there are also thermal effects, because the inside is cold and there's thermal stresses that occur. And the inside was really designed with titanium, mostly, to take care of the thermal expansion. So the airplane had a wingspan of 22 feet, a length of about 49 feet, and a tail height of 14 feet. And so it is a fighter size. The weight at launch, when it was dropped, was 36,300 pounds, and at fuel burnout, 13,000 pounds. And the wing area was some 200 feet, and the sweep back at the quarter chord was 25 degrees. So when you first look at it, you see a typical fighter-sized airplane, World War II type. But when you look carefully, you'll see that there's a blunt leading edge, regular airfoil shape, rather than for supersonic airplanes, which was very sharp, to have the shock waves oblique and attached to the leading edge. And by doing that, they would delay the onset of transonic flow, which begins when the local Mach number, below Mach number of 1, reaches Mach number of 1. So on this one, it's blunt. And it's blunt because Harvey Julian Allen of Ames at NASA discovered that if you have a blunt leading edge and you have a detached shock strong at the front, not all of the heat will get to the airplane. So it reduced that.
It'll literally sit it'll sit a couple inches forward of that leading edge.
Correct. Now,
and
look
we're
at the
talking
vertical
heat. Yeah. What kind of heat are we talking about forward of that leading edge? We're talking more than 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, correct?
We're talking several thousand degrees. The heat on the X-15 is like three times that on the on the X-1. And the X-1...
Go ahead, please.
Well, I want to mention just a few other things. The vertical tail slab, these are things that you can notice if you look carefully. It had a round nose, but instead of having an airfoil shape, it had a blunt trailing edge. It had a 10-degree angle, and that was so that there wouldn't be separation for directional control on the vertical stabilizer. It had little rockets on the wingtips and the front and the tail of the airplane for control when we're in space, when the aerodynamic controls are zero. And they were controlled with hydrogen peroxide. And it had
it had two control systems, the aerodynamic one and the reaction control system as well.
Correct. Externally, there were two. Internally, there were actually three. The pilot controlled it with a normal center stick between his legs for subsonic flight, and until the forces got too great for him to control, he had a power assist. and he had controls on a right console for the power assisted controls. And those were, most of the pilots used that throughout for that part of the flight. And then it had the rocket controls for when the dynamic pressure was zero and the aerodynamic controls were useless. And but they were first used on the Bell X-1E. In fact, I read some of those original numbers for the use of those on that airplane. And then there were skids for landing. Instead of landing on wheels, the airplane would land on skids, one on the right, one on the left, and they were externally mounted. And the reason for that is to avoid the high weight and the volume that regular landing gear would take control of. So there you have the airplane that you can look at and see at the Air and Space Museum. But I'd like to go over a little bit of the history of the X-Airplanes.
That's good, because obviously we talk about the X-1, the X-1A, the X-2, which you all had experience with, and then it all culminating in the X-15 as a research aircraft. Please go ahead and give us a background on that, if you
please. Okay. Well, the X-1 was initiated, I think, at the end of 1944, contracted early in 1945, and it was to investigate supersonic flight to see if you could go through what was then known as the sonic barrier. People, not aerodynamicists, but the regular public had the idea that you couldn't go faster than the speed of sound because the drag buildup was very rapid as you approached it, and nobody was able to fly at that speed. And so John Stack and Ezra Kotcher got together with Bob Woods of Bell Aircraft, who agreed to build this airplane. It was made out of aluminum. It was rocket-powered. It used what's called the XLR-11 rocket engine made by Reaction Motors Incorporated, known as RMI. It had 6,000 pounds of thrust, and that was the engine that Chuck Yeager had in the X-1 when he went faster than the speed of sound. It was to investigate transonic flow. Transonic flow begins when the local Mach number gets up to 1 until the whole airplane is in supersonic flight. That's usually about 1.3 Mach number. Then Bell was asked to make a few changes to go a little higher supersonic, and they designed the X-1A, which was a sleeker fuselage, and it used a different pressurization system for the fuel, which allowed them to carry some more fuel added, turbo pressurized, and it went to a Mach number of 2.44. And then also contracted in, like it was 45, I think it was December, and by the way, the X-1 flew supersonic in 1947 in October. The X-2 went to 3.2 Mach number in 1956, and it was a supersonic design. It had swept wing airplanes, 40-degree sweep, had a sharp leading edge. It was made out of stainless steel and some Caiman-L metal, which wouldn't expand when heated, for the wings and the fuselage. And it was carried aloft to about 40,000 feet in the B-50.
And so and a very pretty airplane. I mean, if you happen to have an eye for aircraft aesthetics, of all the X planes, I've always thought that the X-2 looked really pretty.
It still does. Okay. And then at around 1954-55, NASA, at the prodding of industry, really, said we ought to find out about hypersonic flow, where the temperatures get high. We've discovered that as you go higher supersonically, the directional stability falls off, and you get dynamic stability instabilities. We have to know how to dissipate the heat, and we have to learn how to fly it and see if pilots can really fly this. So the X-15 was initiated. four companies bid it. North American won the competition. And they built an airplane using this Inconel X and the slab tail that I mentioned. They also used a Westinghouse control system, automatic control, so that the airplane would be dynamically stable. And that later was replaced with a Minneapolis Honeywell, an MH-96, for dynamic stability. And it also incorporated the three control systems and the stability at all those speeds in one control system. And it had the rocket space control that we mentioned.
Now, in going and specifying the X-15, NACA, which was evolving into NASA about that time in the late 1950s, was specifying an airplane which, over and above just exploring the basic transonic flows you were talking about, was going to represent a platform for research both at high speeds and incredibly high altitudes that would give it a life much greater than the other X-planes, correct?
That's correct. And the latter flights of the X-15 were all for these experiments that wanted to have their equipments tested and the results determined at these hypersonic speeds. Now,
and
one of the... Okay.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Some people might think that this is going to end up being a fighter plane, but any airplane that's carried aloft in a bomber for an hour and a half before it gets launched and then has enough fuel for like 90 seconds of full-powered flight and then no power at all to come around and land can't be anything but a research airplane. And these airplanes that I've just discussed are like that. The X-15 had 90 seconds of powered flight. Now, they modified it after there was an accident and damage on the number two. There were three airplanes built, number two ship, and with extra fuel tanks and a 29-inch length addition, they had 140 seconds for that. And with that airplane, they did go at the 141 seconds to a Mach number of 6.7. The total drop time, now, from the time that he launches the airplane from the 52, full power, does his experiments, returns to the landing field, which could be as far as 300 miles away, was only 11 minutes. So you can see there was a little bit of excitement to the pilot during this each of the flights.
And it's worth noting that the B-52 was the state-of-the-art strategic bomber at the time, the biggest, the longest range, the heaviest payload, and this aircraft required a B-52 packed with support equipment to be able to take it up to altitude to drop it just to get it in the groove to go ahead and fire up the engine.
And you might say that 50 years later, it's still our primary bomber aircraft.
I literally know people whose grandfathers took delivery of aircraft who are flying it today.
Yep. That's
they talked today
world.
About going and handing over the keys to the family bus, but that's another show and another story.
Originally, the B-36 was supposed to be the airplane to carry it. And with the B-36, like in the earlier X-1, X-2 airplanes, the pilot could fly aloft in the bomber until it was ready for drop, and they topped off the liquid oxygen, and he would get in. But they switched to the B-52 because the B-36 was going out of service, and the expenses of maintaining it over this period of time would have been excessive. Also, the 52 had better speed and altitude capabilities. So the pilot on the B-52 had to get in, pilots of the X-15 went on the had to get in at launch. And when he had to get into the X-15 before the airplane, B-52 took off, And so he rode as a passenger, exposed, if you will. I don't think he was bored because he had a lot of checking things to do until they got about an hour and a half out and at a Mach number of about 0.8, 0.85 Mach number and an altitude of around 40,000 feet. So,
which things got real exciting when they said drop.
yes.
And let's not kid ourselves. It wasn't just the test pilots in the X-15. There was also a very, very talented engineering and test flight crew that flew the bomber most of the time, which, of course, was the legendary High and the Mighty, which I believe is at Wright-Patterson now. But this was a big, big project and very much ran in parallel to Project Mercury at the time.
There were two airplanes, the B-52A and B, that were assigned and were used throughout, but I think there were about 29 different pilots that did the flying, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. I wanted to mention about the engines. When the first flight was ready, the XLR-99, which experimental liquid rocket 99, which is to generate the 57,000 pounds of thrust, and was a throttleable engine, was not ready. And so the first flight, Crossfield had to go without any engine, and he was dropped at about 40,000 feet. And it was the first time that he ever had a chance to feel the controls, because he couldn't even taxi around since they had skids instead of landing gear. So he had roughly 5 minutes from 40,000 feet to touchdown on the lake bed, to learn how to get and handle the controls for the airplane and make an engine. And on that flight, there was a large longitudinal instability, so the airplane was going down and up and down, and with the help of his chase pilots telling him how far he was off the ground, he managed to land it on the bottom of the cycle and not do any damage to the airplane or himself. So, now, there was no engine available for a while because the 99 wasn't ready, and so instead, they installed two of the XLR-11s, which was the engine of the X-1 and X-1A. And they had 6,000 pounds.
And it's worth noting, the XLR-11 is a classic rocket motor that has provided this country with absolutely yeoman service over a period of decades, both as an aircraft rocket motor and actually in use in the space program as well.
Well, it's interesting that RMI, you could say it was a scale-up, but from 6,000 pounds to 57, which is like a factor of 10, plus the fact that the 11 had four nozzles of 1,500 pounds each. So it was almost a scale up of 40 times. So there were difficulties in the mechanics of operating and maintaining it to fire and to thrust it that took it out of that time. And it was decided that they would use two of those engines put in a cradle that actually fit where the XLR-99 was to fit. Now, the fuel was different. They both used liquid oxygen for an oxidizer, but the fuel was anhydrous ammonia, which is different from the water alcohol, but that was also compatible with the tanks. So they ran interim flights. I think they ran about 14 of them with this interim engine. And again, Crossfield was the first one to fly with the interim engines and do that successfully. And then when I think it was a flight 14, when the 99, the 50,000-pound thrust engine was available, he flew that one for the first time. So he flew the airplane until the specifications were met and North American had finished their contractual requirements.
Before we talk about the pilots themselves, and we've already spoken quite a bit about Scott Crossfield, I'd like to talk a bit about the absolute aviation giants at North American Aviation of the day who were involved in the program. Now, for our listeners who say, North American Aviation, what is that? As a corporate entity, they today are part of the Boeing Corporation, and they were acquired several times, first by Rockwell International, the toolmaker out of Pittsburgh, and then later by Boeing after the end of the Cold War. And let's talk about a couple of people that we both know from there. Lee Atwood, what kind of a man was he?
Well, he was a very fine leader. And during World War II, they made the P-51, which was really the fighter that gave us an advantage over all enemies in the war. They were a very fine aircraft company. I was going to also mention Ray Rice, who was the vice president, who was in charge of the design of this airplane, preliminary design, and won the airplane. And then Harrison Storms, who took over from Rice when Rice moved up to be head of the whole company, and he was in charge of all the aircraft. And Stormy, and I'd also like to mention Charlie Feltz, who is the project manager of the program and really responsible for the building of the whole airplane. Now, when Crossfield found that North American won the contract, he left NASA and he joined North American as a design specialist, and he really worked very, very closely and mostly for Charlie Feltz. And he was also the chief pilot, and he was the only pilot from North American who ever flew the airplane. And I really believe that he intended to be the pilot to fly it to the high speed and high altitude. But when the airplane was turned over by contract to the Air Force said, hey, we and NASA are going to fly it. You're finished. And he continued his career. After that, he had a very fine career with North American, with other aircraft companies, and then as I think it was called the Office of Technology Assessment for Congress, and spent most of his time in support of the X-30, supersonic airplane flights. So that's a bit on Crossfield. I wanted to say something before we talk about the pilots, about the risks the pilots have in research aircraft. It should be noted that airlines don't put a passenger in an airline until they've had at least 2 years of testing and everything worked out all right. And in this case, it's the first flight, and he finds out he's going to fly it when he's at 40,000 feet. And so that's a lot different. All the subsystems have to work together. They have to work mechanically. They have to fit electrically, electronically, and thermally, and have to work in the environment now that's flight, and not all of which is known until the flights compare. They have to work hypersonic.
Computerized simulators. I mean, it wasn't like today where you could actually do a first flight in a simulator. The first time you flew it was when they said, drop, have a nice day.
Yeah. Well, this case, they did have good simulators, and they spent a lot of time working on it, and they had to be congratulated. So were the people. And the only one I really knew from there was Dick Day, and I knew him fairly well. And they really were very important because they determined how he would have to fly that airplane, exactly how he would fly it, before the engine cut out, and how to get from there to the data points that they wanted to get, and what if he didn't get exactly there at the burnout, how would he get to those points? And then lastly, if there were emergencies, if things not working or working adversely, how would he be able to handle the airplane? And all those things were studied assiduously by the pilots in excess of 20 hours per flight. And so they also remember they have to fly. Now, this airplane was designed to investigate hypersonics, which was not yet known. That was the purpose of the airplane. Secondly, it had to also fly supersonically, transonically through the speed of sound, and subsonically right on through the landing. And while those things were addressed in the design very carefully, they weren't the primary purpose of the design. So there are many things did go wrong, and we mentioned Crossfield's first flight, and I might have mentioned there was one fatality, but there were 199 flights of this airplane in the roughly 9 years from 1959 to 68. And Mike Adams, who was one of the best pilots that they took on, had flown before, he launched, and I think he had, the engine didn't light right away, and he had a second launch, and then he took off, and he went up, he was up at around 300,000 feet, 250,000 feet, and a Mach number of 5 or so, and at altitude, and he mentioned that it felt a little squirrely, and turned out that he was yawing, and he was not aware of it because he had changed one of the indicators to give him better data when, rather than leave it on yaw. And it turned out later that he was roughly 90 degrees to the flight path, and then he said he was in a spin. So here he is, hypersonic speeds, space altitudes, in a spin. Nobody could help tell him, advise him what to do. He actually worked his way out of that and was at about 60, 65,000 feet, but the automatic control system was banging from one end to the other, and the airplane broke apart at about 62,000 feet, and he was killed. It was another flight out.
More individual before we move on to the, really talking about the bulk of the pilots, and that's someone we talked about the other day who is one of those quiet giants behind the scenes that literally these pilots crawled on to go do their incredible feats, whether it was going to the moon or flying Mach 5. Walt Williams. What do you have to say about Walt Williams?
Well, Walt Williams... I didn't write enough about him in the book. Walt Williams is really the force behind all this. He was appointed as to be in charge of the flight tests of the X-1, and which they did in early flights in Florida. So he hired the people. He hired the pilots. He made sure the things were safe. He had the operation. And it was going real well. And I might mention that things weren't always beautiful between the Air Force and NASA and Bell Aircraft. NASA didn't care much about going supersonic. They really wanted to investigate transonic, and would have been happy to have a turbojet airplane engine fly a little less than the speed of sound. The military really wanted an airplane to fly supersonically and give them an advantage in the military way over anybody else. Bell Aircraft wanted this to be a very successful flight, and they wanted to make sure that they met all the requirements and would therefore get paid for all their efforts, but also have an edge through that airplane in future things. And Walt Williams was very important in seeing that all these things got accomplished. Actually, everybody got their... everything worked out well for everybody. It was a plus thing all the way around.
And this was not just something.
Walt Williams took this out to Edwards Air Force Base, which was secure and had long runways, and the support of the test pilot school of the Air Force, which included Yeager. And he ran that program through the X-1, the 1A, the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5, and was also consulted, as was Crossfield, by the committee when they decided what they were going to have such an airplane to do, testified for it. And then right after the start of the program, the early part of the program, he was elevated to be chief engineer on the Mercury program, and he ended up in charge of chief engineer of NASA. And I ran into him a few other times, once on the manned orbiting lab program. And he doesn't get enough credit. I might say, though, that he was replaced by Paul Bickel, whom I do not know, who had a similar character and regard for safety of the pilots and was quite a person in his own right. And in his time, there were more people employed in this, and it was perhaps a more rigorous structural management. But he also deserves a lot of credit for the success of this program.
We're going to talk about the pilots and the flights after we do a couple of network messages.
Okay.
So we're going to be taking a couple of minutes for messages. And to our listeners, this is the RightStream Radio Network.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network. Tuesday afternoons, you're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. And so we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can. But we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it. In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back. And to our listeners, if you'd like to go and call in and ask a question or offer some opinion regarding the X-15, our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Richard, are you still with us there, sir?
I am. Let me give a little bit of description of the pilots. There were 12 of them. We've already discussed Crossfield. We've mentioned Mike Adams. Everybody probably knows Neil Armstrong, first man to walk on the moon. He was a pilot. He flew 7 times. I think the other pilots assumed and discussed him as probably the best engineer of the whole bunch. He left after 7 flights to join the astronaut corps, and we all know about that. Bob White.
Reputation as a pretty good guy when things started going wrong, whether it was in orbit or I understand he had one particularly dicey flight on the X-15.
He did. He came in at high key, which is about 35,000 feet, supersonic, where he was supposed to have been down to medium subsonic speeds, and had to kill his speed by flying well past it. Coming back, he was a little short, but he did make the field. So that was a little dicey. That was correct. But his reputation is well-deserved. Following his other flights as an astronaut, there was another astronaut who left the program, Joe Engel, who had 16 flights, and he's the last one really still alive since Bill Dana died about a month ago. He left the program to be an astronaut, and it was toward the end of the program, and he was offered either to be a backup pilot, I think it was the last flight, or to switch over to shuttle flights, and he decided he had a better chance of flying on the shuttle flight. So he was a principal shuttle pilot, and having flown the X-15 manually, which is most of the flights on the shuttle were not manual, he is the only one, as I understand, who manually controlled the shuttle from space to landing. And I've met him. He gives talks and so forth. A very fine person. Bob White and Rushworth and Engel, after the flying of the space flights and the X-15 flights, returned to military flight and increased their positions and authority and responsibility in the Air Force, and the three of them ended up as major generals, just to give you an idea that they continued on doing important things in their life for the country. Pete Peterson was the only first represented by the Navy, and he flew several flights, and he went back into the Navy, and he rose in position to be a vice admiral, just to give you an idea how these people go. Joe Walker, who flew the maximum altitude flight in 1963, and he was the chief test pilot for them at Edwards, was killed. They were doing a photographic mission, and he was flying alongside the B-70 and got caught in the wake of the airplane, and the airplanes crashed, and he was killed in that flight. Pete Knight was the one who had the maximum speed, 6.7.
Speed demon. I remember him.
Yes, and he did that in 67, and it was not an easy flight. He was the one who had to restart the engine and go on. But after the engine cut out, it was the A2 version with the extra 50 seconds of power, and they had fuel tanks. They also were carrying a dummy ram jet to see what the effects would be. Later on, they were going to apparently use it. And the shocks off the ramjet impinged on the fuselage, and the hydrogen peroxide tank light went on. And so he had to jettison his peroxide, but also it burned the hole in the aft end. So he was lucky to get back. It was a lot of things on that flight. They did find, he tried to eject the ramjet, and he didn't feel it go off, but eventually it did come off, and they did find it. So he was famous for having set records. Bob Rushworth flew more flights than anyone else. He was the workhorse. He did 34 flights on the X-15. And Bill Dana, who passed away last month, after he got through with his flight testing and stayed with NASA, ended up as the chief engineer, and he was a historian at Edwards Air Force Base. So the pilots, all of them really had engineering or science degrees, and mostly in aeronautics. They worked hard at each flight on the simulators. They really endeavored to be successful by working in preparation. They didn't just jump in the airplane and hot rod it. And
let's talk about a couple of others. Milt Thompson.
Milt Thompson was also a firefighter. He also wrote a wonderful book, you know, as you mentioned. It's called At the Edge of Space, From a Pilot's Viewpoint, and most interested to anybody who reads it. He writes humorously and accurately, and it's a fun book to have.
While Mike Adams was the only fatality in the 199 flights, there was one other that darn near ruined someone's day, and that's John McKay.
John McKay had a flight, and he was by the way, he had 29 flights. He was the second most flew most of the airplanes. When he dropped, he thought he had full thrust. The chase pilot told him that he did, and the ground knew that he didn't. They asked him to land at the emergency field. It was mud field. And he tried to eject all the fuel he could, but he didn't have time to get rid of all of it. His flaps didn't work, so he came in a lot hotter than he was planning to come in. I think something like 20-30% higher speed. And when his skids hit the ground, one of them caught and it flipped the airplane over. And he had the presence to eject his canopy because he wouldn't. If he was upside down with the canopy, they never would have gotten him out. But the first thing that hit the ground on his landing there was his helmet, or his head, if you will. And so there he is upside down. The chase plane pilot landed to help. There was a C-130 Hercules that carried a fire engine that they had at the field, and there were a few other people instrumental, but they tried to dig them out, and there was a cloud of this anhydrous ammonia that was poisonous, and the Piasecki helicopter rotor blades blew the fuel away, and the other people there dug him out and got him onto the 130, flew him back to the base and later on to the hospital. So he was out from flying for a number of months, but he returned and flew for several more years anyhow. His death, they said, when it occurred, well, it was for other reasons. So they thought it was hastened by this accident. So I'm glad you pointed that out, so I could say something about that.
You said that just the compression from the hard landing, you said he was 2.5 inches shorter after this?
Yes.
I think that's kind of the definition of a hard landing.
Yeah, I would say you're supposed to land on your feet, not your head. I just want to say that these are great people. They're some of the greatest pilots in the world, but they all had continued careers at NASA, the Air Force, the Navy. They all set goals. They were dedicated to meeting them. They worked hard to meet them, and they were successful. So I did want to say that they should be admired. People, you know, they talk brightly about heroes and everything else, and people make sport of it, but I think that each of these pilots were heroes.
And it's worth noting, they weren't being covered. I mean, the TV cameras and the media were all out at Cape Canaveral following the Mercury program and later the Gemini program during the time of these flights. I can't recall that there was ever any significant media coverage of the X-15. It was a quiet technical program run by a very discreet and thoughtful group of people, I guess.
Well, I remember it the same way that you do. And but they arose from their positions to importance.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the more memorable flights that didn't involve some form of calamity or the other, because one of the hallmarks of the X-15 was it became a very reliable platform to do aeronautical research on, as we were talking about with Pete Knight's flight, testing out subsystems and seeing what you could do and add and bring to the party.
When I finished the primary purpose of the flights, they had a large number of research programs that they wanted to do, and they did perform them. One of them was to test ablation, and they coated the whole airplane with ablating substance that was made by the Martin Company. And while it worked, it also vaporized and condensed on the windshield, so it essentially blinded the pilot. So after the first flight, I guess the chase pilots brought him down accurately, but they put a shield over one of the windows, the right or the left, and after the high speed was off, they were able to take that away, and so he had a clean window to look through and land. Other things were done, and you might say, well, why did they stop at a number like 199? Well, they really intended to go to 200, and they had three or four flights planned and started, and for one reason or another, subsystem not working or weather being bad, they didn't go through with it, and they finally decided the expense of keeping the airplane up and the pilots going was much more than the benefit of the remaining experiments. I don't have intimate knowledge of any of the other experiments to pass along to you.
One thing that we do know for certain, this is an airplane that set records that stood until the space shuttle in 81 when John Young and Bob Crippen took Columbia up. Talk about the missions that went for altitude and went for speed. I mean, how high could it go and how fast could it go?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I think they did the maximum speed with the airplane with the amount of fuel they had. But the altitude flight, they were limiting it to about 400,000 feet. It could go higher, but there was danger in coming back and reentering. And they figured that it wasn't really worth risking the lives of the pilot and the airplane by going above that. So they set an altitude of about 350,000 feet because if he got 1 degree off in his climb angle, he could gain another 7,500 feet per each degree. If the thrust, by the way, varied sometimes between 57,000 and 60,000 pounds, a 1,500-pound misjudgment, of action of the thrust could cost another 7,500 feet in altitude. And so, and if he cuts off the fuel 1 second late, he would gain another 3,000 feet. So to be sure, he was trying to limit it to about 350, and he did very well with that, ending up at about 354,000 feet.
And the pilot on that was?
Pardon me? The pilot was Joe Walker.
Okay.
And I might say something about flying it that way. He drops, engine goes on, he accelerates, he climbs for a climb angle to about 70,000 feet, then he pushes over at zero lift, to the altitude that he was seeking, usually around 100,000 feet for speed, until the fuel runs out. And then he coasts without the engine, the drag decelerates to landing at Edwards Air Force Base. The maximum acceleration was about 5 Gs when the airplane was empty and a couple of Gs at launch. And Milt Thompson in his book said that it was the only time in his whole flight career that he was happy when the engine shut out. So the 5 Gs was pretty severe.
Yeah, it's worth noting that the shuttle, when it was still flying, had a max specification of around 3 Gs at launch, which, having flown as you have and I have, that's kind of a gentle push into the seat. Your grandmother could handle 3 Gs.
Yeah. Apparently 5 is really excessive. And I might say...
5 gets exciting.
Yeah. I was going to say, for the altitude flight, again, he drops and he starts the engine and accelerates, and he rotates up to about 30 degrees to climb until it cuts out. And then it continues up ballistically. It's a parabolic flight till he hits the maximum altitude. Can't do anything about it. Comes down to the same conditions that he left on the way down. And there, since he's up higher, he glides farther, and it's roughly 300 miles from Edwards Air Force Base when he puts the thing down. So that's how those flights occurred and were performed. And the data was obtained, and it was disseminated to the industry. And it's sorry to say, no airplane since 1968 has piloted aircraft, take off, land, and so forth, has utilized this data. We have no airplanes flying. I fully expect that we will have in the future. A matter of propulsion and probably materials for engines, and also a need either militarily or economically for transport that will stimulate it. But it is 50 years later.
And let's talk a little bit about that speed. Obviously, there were speed runs at various times in the program where they were actually setting world speed records. Talk about a couple of the early runs, which normally, I guess, were done at relatively low altitude, and that way they could, concentrate on putting as much oomph into going sideways. And, of course, later we discussed P-51 Pete Knight's flight, where basically he was burning out systems faster than he could deal with them at the end.
Yeah, or was aware of them.
What were the early ones like?
Well, the early flights, I think with the two XLR-11s engines, they got up around Mach number of 3.5, and they did obtain. Well, I didn't really tell you about the data itself. They found, for example, first of all, pilots can handle this acceleration and deceleration and flying in the atmosphere and flying in space. And that was proved, really, with the shuttle flights afterwards, it's derived from it. The aerodynamic heating was about 30% less than they had predicted from their all-around analytics. Okay? So they're able now to utilize the data that they have and be able to know what percentage to expect and how to expect it. The directional stability problem, they were successful with the wedge-shaped vertical tail and also with the automatic, the MH-96 flight controls system that Minnie Honey had put together. So they were able now to predict the aerodynamic characteristics, the thermal characteristics, the stability characteristics of the airplane and the aircraft flying in space and in the atmosphere. So I think the mission was very well accomplished. Most of these things were accomplished in the early part of the program, I'd say by 1967. The extra year or so was mostly in flying these experiments. And I didn't notice anything earth-shaking in the experiments that I really would make mention of.
And, of course, as you were saying, it also generated a huge volume of data in aerospace medicine at a time when NASA programs, particularly Gemini and Apollo, were desperately trying to understand what they would need for the long-duration flights in the mid-60s and late 60s.
Yeah. Well, one thing physiologically, I guess test pilots get excited too. I think they're all athletes and in good shape and probably have a pulse rate in the 50s normally rather than the 70s that most of us have. But when they flew, apparently the average pulse rate was 120. So there was a little excitement going on during each of these flights.
I'm guessing. The X-15 ran and flew for about 9 years.
Yes.
It generated a huge volume of data, provided a huge repository of information for government and industry to pursue everything from aircraft design to spacecraft design. It also left a historic legacy in the sense that the men who flew it went on to do great and impressive things afterwards. And yet very few people know about the program until they go to one of the museums where the two surviving aircraft are. Talk about the one that's hanging in the main gallery hall at Air and Space downtown on Independence Avenue, because it lives in the same hall as some of the most important aircraft and spacecraft in history. I mean, the Spirit of St. Louis is there. The Wright Flyer
right.
is there.
Wright Flyer.
Chuck Yeager is
there. Our first jet engine, the P-59, is there. You know, it's the gallery of flight, and it's right there when you walk in. Either way you walk in, you see that airplane.
And what do people think of it today? You know, you talked about the fact that you've been supporting the Air and Space Museum for some years since your retirement. What do people want to know about this airplane that when they walk in and see it hanging there?
Well, that's very hard to say. I think there's a great variety, but having done a few book signings and talking to the people, I find that the ones who want a book, largely a lot of them are pilots, or there's somebody in their family is a pilot, and they know something about the airplane. The only thing I can say is it's the most visited museum in the world, and so the interest in aviation is very high, and I think the knowledge, therefore, that people have of this are high. They may not know each specific airplane and its accomplishments, but they're interested in it.
And as you look at it today, having added to the legacy of the and the historic record on the X-15, what do you think? How would you summarize the airplane?
Well, it accomplished what the committee wanted, what everybody wanted for the airplane. It did the speed range, it did the altitude range, it showed what materials could be supported, how to handle it. It supported the fact that the pilots could control it, could handle very adverse conditions, and solve their problems. I might mention that there were some 10 flights where they did land at emergency fields. That's only like 5% of the flights, but that's a very important for their lives in the airplane. So the airplane was really successful in their concerns as well as their accomplishments, and they prepared for them well. And everybody involved in it should be congratulated, and they should not be forgotten.
Very good. You know, you've put together a really beautiful book. And for our listeners, we've talked about a couple of books here today, Milt Thompson's On the Edge of Space, which is very much about what it was to fly the aircraft and the programmatics. Your book is a bit broader and wider in its scope. It's beautifully laid out, much like the other books we've been talking about with authors from Zenith Press. They really did a gorgeous job of integrating the graphics, the pictures and such. And I have to say that if I was going to try and introduce a young person in their teens or early 20s to this airplane, I would definitely give your book to them, because it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of publishing.
Well, I thank you for that. We set out to have a book that people could read who saw the airplane and were interested in more. We kept out all equations, and it's not a big book. It's about 150 pages. And remember that John Anderson, co-author, is one of the world's experts in hypersonics, and so you get a lot out of this book. I might mention, if you wanted to get really details of any of the design points, that Jenkins has written a wonderful book on the X-15, but it's a much big, very big book, about 600-700 pages. And another book is Jay Miller's The X Airplanes.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there are other books on the subject, but we wrote it for the person who's interested in the airplane, but not after any specific exactitudes in design.
Are you
guys
really pleased with the book? On publishing wise? What are you writing now?
Right now, I'm contemplating writing some more about the X-2 and maybe about the X-16. But I haven't really fully decided, but I do intend to continue to work at the Air and Space Museum.
And that's good
to hear.
Sir, if and when you get around doing another book on another airplane, please let us know. I'd love to have you back.
Well, John, thank you very much.
And we're going to go ahead and turn you loose so you can get back to your day. But thank you so much.
Right. You're very welcome. Bye now.
And with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. I hope you enjoyed our talk with Mr. Passman. I know I found it fascinating, since I grew up around the X-15 program. My family worked rather intensively with North American Aviation in years gone by, and many of the names and the people that you've heard today are in fact people from my youth, And it was fun going back and remembering some very fine men and the excellent work they did. We're going to go and call it a day here. I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Military Monday. We'll be back next week with another show. Please take care, and I hope that we have you here again very, very soon. Take care.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV and a man with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cry. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's a song?
Yeah.